Hey, what's going on, everybody, and welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast. My name is Vlad Sedler. You can find me on all the social media sites at RotoGut. And Jason Anthony is, I believe, out there playing another fancy golf tournament, and in his stead, we have two fancy people, at least in the fantasy rotisserie sphere, and they are colleagues of mine. And they are both overall champions in the NFBC. I'll introduce them one at a time. You know him as Red Fox Roto, our bullpen guru, Mr. Dan Thompson. Dan, what's up? Welcome to the pod.
Thank you. My debut appearance.
It is here, indeed. And along with us is, what was I going to say? I had a really nice intro for you, but now I completely flubbed it. Anyways, yeah. You've known him. He's been on the pod many times at Bronx Yankees 23. I was going to say something like the pride of the Bronx or something like that, but I don't know if that's pride still the Yankees. Case.
Yeah.
Mike Mager.
Hey, Clive. How's it going?
Oh, good, good. We're a week into the season. It feels like it's been several weeks now, but we're in full fab mode, and we're going to have a lot of fun things to talk with you about today. Kind of keep the flow as usual, but we're going to talk a little bit of bullpen reports, especially because we have Dan here. We're going to talk some drops ahead of the weekend with Mike, and a lot of interesting in-season stuff. But I want to first ask Mike, how is your season going so far with your early player shares? Do you ever get in like panic mode or excitement mode? Like, where are you in the season right now?
No, honestly, I guess I've been doing this long enough that I really don't sweat standings, especially after a week or two. So for me, I definitely want my teams to get off to a good start, but I'm more focused on hopefully maintaining health on my teams. The Josh Lowe injury was probably my biggest early blow, but it's great to have real baseball again. Great to be tracking my teams and managing lineups and doing fab, and it's been great.
Dan, what are you playing, by the way? I know we have been in a league together. We did an OC. You've been on a couple of preseason streams. And what all are kind of your biggest teams? And I've seen, obviously, some of them, at least in the league that we're in together, I'm already fearing your build there. And especially, I know you got some fab skills. So what do you have that you're rooting for this year?
Well, I'm in the CLQ again. And the DC is an early disaster again. Mm-hmm. But of course, my biggest league then will be the main event in the CLQ. And I've got three other OCs and Wharf in the Earth Leagues. I've got, I think, 8 total fab leagues this year. I'm kind of stretching myself, but I'm really, keyed in this year doing the bullpen report. I've never really been this zeroed in on specific roles for every reliever and who's pitching in exactly which situation, how many pitches did they throw, were they available the next day. So that's really helping with the reliever side of things, but just I feel more in the zone this year than ever before, so I hope that translates to success in the end.
Yeah, you can ask Mike about that. His first year rookie season as a fantasy writer, obviously crushed it in the auction and all of his other drafts last year. But yeah, there really is something to it. And, you're obviously not the first person that's done this bullpen report, but everyone that has in the past is just like, wow, it's just this incredible world. And when you're dialed in, you really feel sort of ahead of the game. Like you can almost just by monitoring the usage of the relievers and the bullpens, you can kind of get a feel on when you could potentially get a discount on some of these relievers. And it's really, really something special.
Yeah, I was able to add Dennis Santana in both my fab CLQ leagues, the main and the OC, for a total of $9. So that felt good, to get an early one, right?
Yeah, that's looking good.
So far.
Yeah, that we're going to talk definitely about some bullpens here in a bit, and even prepare you for fab coming up, because in 15 teamers especially, I'm sorry, in 12 teamers especially, there are definitely a bunch of saves most likely available, and same thing in 15s, and of course that changes week to week. There's usually somebody there to chase. Before we do, wanted to ask, start with the topic of torpedo bats. My gut feelings column that is back after a couple years off, just kind of looking at things from the midpoint of every week and looking at batting orders and trends and things like that. But these torpedo bats are really interesting. The first thing that stands out to me is, the first rule of torpedo bat is you got to be able to make contact. Otherwise, you're not going very far.
Yeah, I have a feeling a few months from now, this will be much ado about nothing. It seems like these are legal bats and that they're not exactly brand new. I mean, I guess, they've been developed a year or two ago or a couple of years ago, and some players have been using it. It's certainly the Yankees made news, a couple of their hitters using it at a big opening weekend. But there are some other teams that have been using it as well, other players. If you can't hit the ball, it doesn't matter. And I'm not sure how well the players can really control where they happen to hit the ball on the bat at least with great frequency. So I'm sure it'll help on some pitches and maybe hurt them on others.
Yeah, I read something about how the bats designed by this analyst Lenny, used to work for the Yankees, now with the Marlins, he developed them specifically to each, I guess, person's player's tendencies, like Volpe's extra wood or sweet spots a little bit closer to his hands, whereas someone's are a little bit more on the outside. And then funny enough, Aaron Judge that day when he hit all those homers, I mean, he doesn't even use one. He's just basically is in the mode of, don't need to break something that doesn't need fixing or whatever that phrase is.
Yeah, I think he's getting by without it so far. But yeah, it makes sense. And I just find it kind of interesting though, because I mean, we've been basically using like the same bats for decades and decades. And so kind of a new development that's within the rules is kind of interesting. And I think it only makes sense that the players have bats that are tailored for their preferences in terms of length and weight. So, in terms of also tailoring the distribution of the weight on the bat seems to be kind of a logical advancement.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing you hear about with golf clubs all the time. How they've added more weight to one side or the other to help for, if you've got I forget the terms. I haven't played golf in quite a long time, but, just different areas of the club can help depending on where you hit the ball. So I'm kind of surprised we haven't seen this earlier in baseball. The way that pitchers are using kind of science and physics and everything to help them design pitches, hitters need something. And this is just a kind of a cool idea to bring some science to the hitting side of things.
Yeah, I saw a chart. This is very, I guess it's pretty insignificant because you can't really look at a sample of a barrel rate from like a 6-game sample, but it is just fun or interesting to look at. But this guy I'm friends with on Twitter had me on one of his shows, I think on VSiN. Jared Smith Betts, he basically showed last year's, the guys that are using the torpedo bat, last year's barrel rates compared to so far this season. And of course, as you can imagine, every comment in that under that post is, put sample size. Yeah, we know that. We understand. But it is interesting, though, like Jazz Chisholm, for example, had a barrel rate under 10%. It's closer to 30%. Again, of course, he was mashing them. So Volpe's is up double, same with Ellie's, Alec Bohm's, Adley's. And then a couple of guys have zeros because Junior Caminero and Lindor of the Mets have no barrels so far. Both of those guys were at or over 12%. And of course, we look at this in the end of the season, it's going to completely sway, going to be all over the place. But they're interesting. That's a good point, Mike. I could definitely see it. It's just like the fun thing to talk about now. It is new. It's interesting. It's different. But we'll see where we are with this a few months from now.
Yeah, and I do think one of the things that will be interesting to watch is, to some extent, this is very much a copycat league. And so to the extent there are well-known players having increased success with it, I would expect more and more players to adopt it. And so it'll be interesting to track because I can see many players kind of adopting it mid-season and seeing how You know, we'll have to look at their stats pre and post torpedo bats. Something else to look at in the offseason.
Let's talk about the minor league ballparks that are in play. Obviously, we knew in the preseason there was, I guess, some, you know, like the Sacramento Park, Sutter Health Park. There were people that were saying, well, it's not as much of a hitter's park as you think it is. And other people saying, yes. But for at least for me, like just the common sense or logic of the fact that it's a minor league park. And again, like a broken record, but I'll say it, in the hot, hot, hot heat of Sacramento, it gets very hot there. And I'm guessing, I don't know when they'll have some of those games. Most will be evening games, but there'll be some 100, you know, 5, 110 degree games, days. And we already saw 44 runs scored in the opening series there in Sutter Health. Of course, a lot of that had to do with those, you know, the fact that you had kind of mediocre Sacramento or Athletics pitchers pitching to what I think is a pretty solid Cubs team with a lot of power. But obviously, you know, Seiya Suzuki finally woke up. By the way, he leads the league in strikeouts, but he's also mashing. That was a great series for him, obviously. 9 ribbies in 3 games and what was it, 3 home runs. Kyle Tucker off to a phenomenal start. I mean, those Cubbies, just they just look good in general. Dan, aren't you like originally a Cubs fan, or am I wrong?
Nope, 35 years in Chicago. I'm a Cubs fan.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's right. What do you think of the early prospects of them being a, you know, I remember I said something on Twitter, oh, they're going to be a top 10 offense, and people, I mean, it was crazy. People were like, "What? What are you talking about? No way." I'm like, "No way." I think so.
No, it definitely looked like it was possible. You know, you add Kyle Tucker there. If you get a full season of health from Seiya Suzuki, you know, you could definitely see that Yelich season coming. You know, Pete Crow Armstrong, another year to develop. Matt Shaw was an exciting rookie, you know, to take over third base. Nico Horner, he's coming off the surgery, but he's been an excellent bat. Not a lot of power, but, you know, he does a good job making contact, stealing bases. This team can do a little bit of everything on offense. So they definitely had the capability to score a lot of runs if, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 of those guys all had good seasons at the same time. And maybe that's happening.
And with the ballpark there, I mean, you know, all those runs scored, obviously that's not a pace that's sustainable. There will be 3-2 games and such there. But in general, like, are you going to be looking extra, I guess, to stream offenses or players that are going to that park and say, you know, George Steinbrenner Field maybe didn't get off to as great of a start with that ballpark, but I think there's going to be a lot of mashing, both lefties and righties, but specifically with the lefty bats. And of course, it's because Pittsburgh and Colorado were the first two series there. I mean, if you had the Yankees there, it'd be a whole different story, I'm sure. But in general, are you kind of giving these two ballparks extra attention from a streaming perspective?
I probably will be later in the season if we really see some definitive data that's showing that, yeah, these are offensive ballparks. You know, these are Coors Light style parks. Right now, it's kind of wait and see. I was definitely in on the Rays hitters in draft season. I expected Steinbrenner Field to play as a very high octane offensive park. I wasn't quite sure what to think about Sutter Health. It was a pitcher's park relative to the rest of that league, which is an extreme hitters league. So how does that translate when you put that park up against all the other MLB parks with MLB players hitting in it? So I wasn't as sure about that one, but Steinbrenner Field, I was definitely interested in adding those Rays hitters, especially the lefties and Junior Caminero, if I could, because he has that opposite field power.
Yeah, I agree with everything Dan said. It's also, it's kind of early to make definitive decisions on them. I also was in on Rays hitters this year. I mean, to some extent, it's really look at the opponents and look at the players there. You know, the Yankees got off to an enormous hitting start, and you were wondering, you know, is it the torpedo bats or the stadium? But it may have also been the Brewer pitchers. You know, Zach Gallen had no problems there. So the other night. So I think you really have to kind of wait and see. I mean, the A's didn't throw a great set of pitchers against the Cubs, and frankly, the Cub pitchers didn't look that great either. So let's give it another couple of series before we, you know, make definitive calls on the parks.
And it wasn't just that the starters weren't looking good. I mean, the bullpen has been horrendous. I mean, Porter Hodge has been solid, but their closer, Ryan Pressly, quite shaky. And the rest of that pen has just been horrific. I think even Eli Morgan, who was typically a solid vet, you know, played for the Guardians or the Indians, but he, I think, got demoted or was not going to make the team originally. And I think someone got injured in the pen. He ended up in there and then just got absolutely blasted. And then, you know, I've been a little bit back into the DFS game because I'm adding three times a week. We have our, you know, our DFS here at FTN, and we have our like core plays and exposure. So I'm doing the work and I'm doing some research and then sort of recommending players. And so, you know, I was in on that series and I don't know, I was looking at it. I'm like, I think I'm going to just go with hitters against Justin Steele. I see he had a very shaky spring. He had a not so great first start in Tokyo. And then again, I don't know. And now he's in this park. Let's go with some A's righties here. And of course, there we had it. Brent Rooker hit a bomb. Shea Langeliers hit a bomb. And honestly, I would have, I'm really mad at myself. So I had a Cub stack with A's on this one day, and it was not the Steel day. It was the day before that. And I popped in Carson Kelly, and then I decided, you know what? Let me go with somebody I feel a little better about. I don't need to have all Cubs here. Let's go with Yvonne Herrera because I have the extra salary. So Yvonne Herrera, I think, went 0 for 3 and then got pulled for Pedro Páez. And then, of course, he hits three bombs 2 days later. And then, meanwhile, Carson Kelly has the freaking cycle. And yeah, so that was like probably a five-figure mistake, but like, yeah.
DFS. You need to have Carson Kelly getting the season's first cycle on your bingo card, huh?
Did not have that on my bingo card. By the way, the Athletics, they have a all-home series this upcoming week. They've got the Padres visiting, and obviously everybody that has their Padres, you're going to be starting them. And then the Mets come to town during the weekend, so that'll be fun. Maybe the Mets bats will wake up a little bit. I think those guys, at some point, you know, Mark Vientos will get going. Lindor is not hitting really well. We haven't seen like full-on Soto yet. Seems like the only guy that's really popping off there is Pete Alonso.
Yeah, he had a big grand slam, I think, the other day. Yeah, they've been a little quieter than I would have expected. I kind of thought of them as a top 10, maybe top 5 offense this year, but we haven't seen it yet. But I agree, it's still very early.
Yeah, we have to remind ourselves, it's been a week. It's a 6-month season. We're reacting to the only information we have to react to. So that's fine to do, but we have to, you know, temper ourselves a little bit and just remember there's a lot of season left to play.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I you know, what happens, especially for people who are really love the fantasy baseball space, is you know, you spend a lot of the winter, you know, analyzing players and doing drafts, and you all with a, you know, looking ahead for real baseball, and we finally got it, and so we're all eating it up as much as we can. But really, it's 7 days at this point, so. Overreacting is very easy to do.
Well, on that topic, I wanted to ask you guys about some FOMO. Yeah, that's a part of my final article of every preseason where I talk about players that I have the most exposure to in my drafts. And then also, you know, usually I write about some players that I, you know, just had that fear of missing out on. Jason Booms and I talked about it last week. But I wanted to ask you both the same question. Just going through 1 week of action, who are some of these players that you already are feeling this way? And who do you feel like among those players, is it a legit feeling, right? Because based on what we said, like, we are all players that you know, we're all fantasy players, the three of us, I believe, that exhibit more patience than, I guess, your average fantasy player. Like, we kind of are able to step back and realize the longevity of the season. But we can also get swept up in it a little bit. But like, how do you know for sure some of these players that we're going to talk about that it's that you really do have that fear of missing out? Or like if, you know, 2-3 weeks down the line, that guy just got blasted 2 starts, you know, your pitcher got blasted or your guy's on a 0-for-12 streak, you know, how do you differentiate that after you tell me who these players are?
Well, Mike and I actually were talking a little bit about this topic beforehand here. And the guy in the first round that I missed out on that I really wish I had a share of was Elly De La Cruz. And at first I wasn't really in on him at the beginning of draft season, but as we got spring training information and he had his swinging strike rate under 10%, he had the contact rate around 75%. Elly De La Cruz with contact skills? Whoa. I mean, staff predictions column, you know, I named him as a potential overall fantasy number one player. And I wish I'd gotten a share. So far this year, he's got the strikeout rate at 24%, very manageable. The zone contact, I think, what'd I say, Mike? It was like 96%. It's a ridiculous number. Overall, it's in the 60s. Not fully Elly from last year, maybe a little bit of improvement, but man, if he can sustain any of those spring training gains at all, and you get something close to a 270 average, maybe 30 homers, another 50-something stolen bases, he's hitting third in that lineup now instead of second. The RBI opportunities should be higher. You really could see an Acuna 2023 type season.
100%. But I was going to ask you, is it true FOMO if you never had a shot at him? It's not like you had a number. Did you have a 4 pick and pass on him? Or is it just you never got that spot to take him?
I got 1, 2, and 3. And then 6 through 15. He was mostly being taken 4th and 5th, and that's literally the 2 positions I never got.
Interesting. Okay.
So that the one time I did pick 3rd, I took Aaron Judge. I was very happy with it, but it was mid-February. You know, I didn't have what looked like maybe some improvement in the contact area. I didn't have that available yet, so it wasn't even a decision. You take Aaron Judge there. But in later drafts, I was putting number 3, 4, 5 at the front of KDS, just hoping I could be in position to just get him once.
He's a fun player to own, but I think he'll be okay with Judge. That's just
fine. Oh, I'm plenty happy with Judge.
I thought of 4 players that I'm kind of having FOMO on now, but for different reasons. One is Cedric Mullins, who for years and years I've been higher on than the market. I've had like a lot of shares of Mullins, and I was kind of off him this year. I only have a couple of small shares. I didn't get him in any big draft. I was worried about a lot of mouths to feed in the outfield, and they were using him as a platoon bat last year, sitting him against lefties and hitting him down in the order. But he's off to a great start. Colton Cowser is now out for 2 months, which, you know, I think removes any big playing time risk. And I think Mullins may have a very good year for other fantasy managers. So that's one. Eugenio Suarez is a player that I haven't been super high on. I just always been nervous about the average. And you know, I kind of just view him as a cheap power, but he's off to a fantastic start, kind of picking up from an incredible second half last year. So I'm worried that the new and improved Suarez may have some staying power, and I will not be having any of that. One that I think maybe real, or at least circumstances have changed, is O'Neill Cruz, who's a player I liked. I do have him on one big team, but I did not foresee the Pirates running as much as they have early on. And if that continues, I think Cruz is going to be, and he stays healthy, I think he's going to be a highly profitable player, probably return first round value. And I don't have enough of him for my liking. And the last one is Christian Campbell. He's off to a fantastic start. I have a few shares in early DCs, but I didn't get him in any big leagues, and I'm kind of kicking myself now for not being more aggressive on him. He started playing better the last part of spring training, the last couple of weeks, and it did become pretty clear he was going to be the everyday second baseman, but I was not nearly as aggressive as I think I should have been on him. And he's just hit the ground running, and I think he's going to be a major fantasy contributor this season.
Yeah,
so Christian, those are my four early regrets after 1 week.
Yeah, it's funny. So a couple of those guys off to great starts. I'm still being stubborn on, and of course could be wrong, but Cedric Mullins and Eugenio Suarez, I both had below ADP and, with my ranking. And of course, could absolutely be dead wrong there. We'll see. I do still think that Eugenio Suarez is going to, actually both of them are probably not going to be great average guys. I think they're both off to nice starts, but it does, at least early on, and there is a lot to hot starts, because guys that get off to hot starts are more likely to, get their, potentially have that big season. And both those guys have had their big seasons in the past, but just like a profitable season, that's usually how those things start. You rarely see somebody coming off injury or, things getting going in June. It's, the hot start, I think, is really, really important. As far as, who was the last guy that you mentioned?
Christian Campbell.
Yeah. So I don't think there's anyone that yo-yoed more in VDP 500, because it was like, oh, he's not going to make the team. Go drop him back down to like 300. He's going to for sure. Oh, but the talent. Oh, this and that. Oh, but the defense. Right before the season started, right? It was like, well, he's not quite there defensively. I ended up with him on one of my four big teams. So I have three mains in the ultimate auction, and so it was just like a random, like, let's just do it here. Let's grab a share. And so far, I've been happy. It's been pretty solid. But honestly, most of my FOMO comes on not having some of like my guys on the majority of my teams. Dan alluded to it. For those that listen that are not FTM subscribers, and the cat's out of the bag, Seiya Suzuki is my this year's Yelich. And I have a million shares on him on DCs and Gladiators and OCs. I think I have him on three or four OCs. But in the auction, it just didn't work out as part of the plan. I paid up. I'm not complaining. I got Tatis and Tucker, and I just wasn't going to be able to afford that as well, and just have that super expensive outfield. But then in my three mains, I only have one Suzuki. So I'm a little bummed about that. Ivan Herrera was a guy I was all in on, but in one of those mains, it was somebody picked them up, scooped them up two rounds beforehand. And then Victor Scott, I had a fight for that guy. It's part of the game. I have to be completely transparent, and I've been tweeting about him since February. Never in my wildest dreams did I think it would go like this well for him. But then that cost me too. Lots of great early shares. That's great. There are no promises of greatness over the next few months, but it's nice to see he made the team. He's been running. He seems like really confident, and it's a really weird thing when you're into St. Louis Cardinals. Like this year, it's like, we kind of don't know about management. We don't know about that team. Sonny Gray's alluding to things being weird, but like individually, I like a lot of these fantasy players, because a lot of them were just so cheap. Lars Utbar, Victor Scott, like even Arenado was going like 250. I was in a lot of those guys. So that's pretty much where my FOMO lies.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes the toughest blows are the ones where you're on a guy, but don't get him or don't have enough of him. I agree. It can be frustrating. Or you get him in your early drafts, like the draft champions, the lower stakes, and sometimes the price rises and you're not aggressive enough going up there and getting them. So yeah, I agree.
You ever have that feeling where you think you have more shares of somebody, and then you go click on your player shares, you're like, oh wait, I didn't get them as much?
Yes. Christopher Sanchez, Jonathan India, a bunch of guys I liked and was getting a lot of early in the drafts that don't matter as much. Their prices shot up, or they just kept being taken a little bit before I was ready to pull the trigger on them. And I look through my my CLQ teams and I don't have them there. It's like, but these are guys I loved. And I just couldn't get them when the price kept going up.
Yeah, Matt McLean is that guy for me. I was aggressively drafting him, and I do have him on three of my bigger teams, but I should have gotten him on more.
What about some of these, like the speed, right? So again, it's a 1 week sample. There's not a lot we can, there are not a lot of conclusions to be made off of it. We're not projecting that there are going to be even more steals than last season, but it's up around 18% through this time last season. So just through 1 week of the season, I drilled down into like the exact days, and there were actually more rainouts at this point of the season last year through the first week. But either way, stolen bases, just from the snapshot of first week of the season, including two Tokyo games both years, it's up about 18%. O'Neill Cruz leads the league with the six swipes, which is pretty incredible for 1 week. But then, you know, Fernando Tatis, love to see it. This is a guy that, what was it, 2 weeks ago was said, hey, I was playing on like one leg last year, so this year I'm going to be running. And that's exactly what he's doing. But then his teammate, Manny Machado, is as well. He's got four stolen bases. So how are you guys looking at this, just in, I guess, maybe on any individual player that you're looking at, especially Dan, you wrote three articles, a series about these stolen bases. But just from a perspective of steals from a roto perspective in FAB over the course of the year.
Well, I know Vlad, when we did the Beat Vlad OC live stream, I had mentioned that in my research, I found between 2021 and 2022, there was an increase in stolen bases league-wide. And between 2023 and last year, similar increase. Now, between 22 and 23, we saw that huge explosion in stolen bases. You know, the rules changes made stealing bases much easier. But I think if those rules changes hadn't been put in place, we would have seen a similar increase. Like maybe a couple hundred stolen bases have been added each league year. So when I wrote the article about the category percentile targets and, you know, using my method of kind of adjusting based on where league trends have been going, batting average is trending down. So I adjusted my targets down a little bit for batting average, but stolen bases have been rising, even independent of the rules changes. So I increased stolen bases and made my targets higher. And I targeted more stolen base players later in drafts, especially reserve picks. I tried to get as much power as I could early and then just draft like two or three guys that I thought had 30 stolen base potential in reserve rounds. You know, just so that I had guys I was keyed in on my roster in case they did go off. I missed on some of those picks, but I think it was the right idea. And we're seeing that play out. Stolen bases are up again.
Yeah, and I think from a fantasy perspective, one of the big things I'm taking away and I want to get better in for next year is just doing maybe more of a team-by-team analysis. I mean, I think all the teams or most teams have certain speedy guys, but what the big takeaway for me early is how team dependent stolen bases can be. It's very driven by team philosophy. And just, you know, at this point in time, I'm just quickly looking at Fangraphs. So the Pirates lead Major League Baseball with 19 steals. Padres are second at 15. Cubbies are third at 11. But then you have 18 teams that have four or fewer stolen bases as a team. So Tatis has more stolen bases right now than 18 teams. And the Athletics and the Guardians are still looking for their first stolen base. So that's, you know, maybe bad news for J-Ram and Kwan, Lane Thomas. So, I mean, they have base stealers, and I'm sure they're going to get going and start running. But there's definitely, you know, it seems like Pittsburgh, it's part of their approach to this season. I thought Miami, too, they got off to a quick start with running, but they've slowed down a little bit. But I think that's something I want to get better at and trying to look more to see if there was information available during spring training that would have highlighted some of these teams that are running a lot more now, or if it was just something that was undiscernible going into drafts.
Dan, was there anything like that? I know you kind of touched on some of these things in your articles, but is there anything that we maybe need to look at next year? Like, how do we find that type of information to be able to make an assumption on it? Is it just like manager specific quotes or trends? Like, I don't even know the answer. Maybe I'm putting you in a bad spot with this question, but I feel like you have some answer.
This was all in my articles.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, to tell the hip. I remember.
I read it, but did I do what I just said I was going to do? No.
Yeah.
No. We can see manager based patterns. Some teams just have a higher stolen base rate year to year, and Washington under Dave Martinez has been one of them. The Brewers under Craig Counsell were one of them. So Counsell moving to the Cubs, it was no surprise that the Cubs then became one of the more aggressive teams. But Pat Murphy taking over in Milwaukee actually kept the pace. Milwaukee attempted, I think, the second most stolen bases in the majors last year. And then in the spring, of course, we saw Jackson Chourio steal, I think, 6 or 7 bases, and he was one of the leaders in spring. So there are patterns, definitely. Pittsburgh is a surprise. You know, they were one of the teams under Derek Shelton that was just kind of middle of the pack, just hanging around. But O'Neill Cruz late last year in the second half in, I think, 60, 61 games was 15 for 15 stealing bases. He was still overcoming that broken ankle even early last year, a full year after the injury. But once he got his feet under him, he was running a lot late in the season, and he was stealing bases in the spring. So he was a guy I targeted in some early rounds. Eventually, I thought the price was a little too high for a guy who is a batting average risk, but I wrote him up in one of the articles as a 30-plus stolen base candidate, as a guy who could set a career high this year. So there's definitely little signs you can look for, but stolen bases also are kind of volatile year to year, maybe even more so than home runs. It's kind of a crapshoot sometimes, but you can target specific teams based on actual data year to year, how many they attempt in general.
It's just such an interesting topic in general. Like, I remember, I mean, obviously, we had a multitude of phenomenal content on the site all winter, but that series, man, that was like, yeah, it was compelling stuff. Like, I went back, like, remember I was reading it before we sent it off to the editors. I'm like, man, this is the goods right here. It's just a interesting talk, and we want to be ahead of these things, like in all categories and all the trends. So I think next year it'll be fun to kind of look back at this season. See what you kind of hit on, new lessons learned, and see how we can apply it for 2025, 2026.
Oh, I want to bring the series back next year.
Oh yeah, it's coming back.
Yeah,
it's already approved. Let's talk bullpens a little bit here, and then we'll jump into the weekend and some fab look ahead. Let's start off with the chaotic situations, and obviously in Pittsburgh, you've got David Bednar just absolutely choking that this past weekend, and then sent down to the minors on Monday. Colin Holderman not doing too well, and then Dennis Santana, your boy Dan, good call on that. He ended up grabbing a save. You got him for much cheaper than I did. I got him for I'm just like the classic early April overpayer. I really hate it, especially I'm supposed to be like the fab guy, and here I am like, you know, I got him for 24. I'm excited, and you got him for like 7.
So. Yeah, 7 in my main and 2 in an OC.
Jeez. Yeah, so we were talking about this in the show or before we started recording, but how do we see that shaking out, and especially with Mike? You got the drops column on the weekend. I'm guessing Bednar is probably going to be a part of that column. But
yeah, well, Mike asked before we started recording, you know, about Bednar specifically in that situation. And if there's a quote from Derek Shelton out there about what the plan is for Bednar, I haven't read it yet. So we can really only go by how these situations have played out in the past. And typically with a reliever like him, who was so good 2021 to 2023, obviously was not good last year, was not good in the spring, was not good in the first week of the season. He earned his way out of the closer's role. But he's the kind of guy with a track record who can quickly earn his way back. So is he a drop? As always, the answer is it's dependent on your team. you know, whether you can afford to hold him, whether you need the roster spot or not. But this is a situation where he could go down to AAA, throw two or three scoreless innings. The team says, okay, he's back. Let's give him another shot. He comes back. Maybe he throws the eighth inning in his first appearance, and then they throw him right back into the ninth inning. Couple saves in a row. Hey, he's the guy again. That can happen. Of course, it might not happen, but this is a probabilistic game that we play, fantasy baseball. You try to think of odds, you know, what decision can I make that's in my favor? And the odds would say the Pirates want him to be their closer. Their bullpen works better if they have good David Bednar in the ninth inning closing games. So I think he'll get that chance, and it's probably a high probability that he gets that chance. Then it's up to him to keep it.
That makes a lot of sense to me, and I agree. And I think another factor maybe is I think Santana certainly looked good, has looked good so far, but I'm not sure he has the staying power to hold down that job. And of course, if Bednar doesn't improve and there's no real competition, he may just do that. But if Bednar's pitching well, I guess I'm expecting at some point Santana to run into some troubles.
Yeah, and Santana, you know, he started last year with the Yankees.
Yeah, I know.
And his K minus walk percentage was negative, I think, or at least it was very low. Once he got to Pittsburgh, it went up over 20%. He was a different guy. He was great. He had a solid spring. He's had a good start. But he's not a guy with a long track record. And he has had some control issues in the past. You never want to see that pop up with someone in the ninth inning. So, again, thinking probabilistically, not a great chance. He is the type of pitcher that can keep that role all year. So get some saves while you can. Expect Bednar to come back eventually. If Bednar is not the guy, Santana's probably not going to be the guy the whole season either. They'll cycle through guys until someone sticks for a little while.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm also thinking from the perspective of if you have the opportunity to add David Bednar, and if we're talking NFBC leagues, like I'm looking at the structure of my teams and I already have a couple of stashes, and a lot of them are of the pitching variety for the most part. It's like I have more starters and like spec closers than I do hitters. So I can't really drop the hitters, and I'm not dropping Brandon Woodruff, you know, guys like that. But I would like to, I feel my teams feel more comfortable when I actually get a third closer, because I know at some point, one of my first two, something's going to happen to them. But having like a Bednar, maybe Alexis Diaz when he gets back, I think he's somebody else that probably they, you know, the Reds want to have in that role. It would be nice. But the question is, can I personally afford to stash them on my team? So I think that's something everyone kind of needs to look at, because these are buying opportunities. These are long-standing closers, guys that, you know, over the last few years have been pretty good, albeit Diaz shaky and Bednar horrible last year. But these are probably the odds-on favorites to end up with their team's lead in saves. So then my question related to that is, you got three guys, and I guess I'm kind of jumping around here with the bullpens, but so three guys in main events that are in the 70 to 80% rostered range, meaning they're available in about 20 to 30% of main event teams. And, you know, like how should we be spending on them? One of them is Dennis Santana. He's available in 28% of mains. Another is Anthony Bednar of Miami, who at this point with Tinoco on IL, Calvin Fauché, who I learned from Dan is the correct pronunciation. Booms and I have been butchering it, calling him Falker, you know.
Well, Fauché. I learned it from Phil.
Oh, yeah, of course.
French Canadians. It should be accurate.
Yeah. I'm also supposed to be a professional podcaster. I should know all the names. Sporer is great at that, by the way. He knows all the names. But Anthony Bender it seems like the guy there, especially he got the last save and the usage and all. And then there's Tommy Conley, who, you know, based on his arsenal, isn't like your prototypical closer. But with the way Tyler Holton should be used, and probably Knight, not just like a direct closer because he's so valuable elsewhere. And the fact that Bo Brisky has been shaky, Will Vest is, you know, another one of them relievers. But Santana, Bender, and Conley are all in that, you know, 20 to 30% available range. Is it pretty simple as far as the prioritization with Bender there at the first, as the first guy?
I don't know that's simple. I think Bender and Santana are probably in similar positions right now. They're sort of maybe closers on teams that aren't going to get a lot of wins. So I wouldn't spend a lot of money to figure out if they're going to keep the job very long. I would kind of assume that they're not. And, you know, just put in a reasonable bid to try and get them and maybe pick up 3 to 5 saves over the next couple of weeks. For Santana, maybe Bednar comes back and he's just back to a setup role. You know, for Bender, maybe he's just not that good. And maybe Fauché turns things around, gets another shot. Maybe Tinoco comes back and you know, he throws some clean innings and he gets a chance after Bender blows a save. I think Pittsburgh and Miami are kind of fluid situations still. There's a little more clarity now, but this is not something where I think, okay, we've got 5+ months of these guys as closers. Let's go pay $150 in FAB for them.
I agree with that. And the only thing I'd add is I think the Tigers feel more like a committee. I mean, maybe Canley will get a few more shots, and but I don't know that any of them are kind of what we think of as traditional or prototypical closers. And I can see them playing matchup all season. But I do agree that if you're going to shop for Tigers reliever right now, I guess I'd give Canley the edge based on recent usage.
Yeah, and we're recording this before the weekend series, and Will Veskin grabbed 2 saves, right? And then that can end up being fool's gold. That could have just been situational. I think that's why kind of looking at the, you know, who they're facing and all that is so important. But then it could just, you know, maybe just go back to being Brisky. Maybe Brisky gets going, right? I mean, that's the whole point of this and what we're all talking about. These things are so fluid that got to be careful paying a lot of money for these guys. For somebody that you may just end up holding on for a couple of weeks. I'll never forget. I think I bid 2 or 3 times on Rafael Dolis for the Blue Jays, like 3 times, but like 150, then dropped them, then got him back. And just like, I just kept chasing in the wrong direction and chasing my own tail. I think I ended up with like 1 save and an 8 ERA.
I think the challenge for fantasy managers is trying to anticipate the unlikely closer, because you know, it's easy to say, you know, that Santana and Bender are not worth spending a lot of money on. And I agree with you. They're not particularly strong relievers, and the situations are fluid, as Dan mentioned. But the reality is facing us is like if you're in a very competitive contest like the main event and, you know, 15 managers have $800, $900 of FAB, they're not going to go cheap, not this weekend. I mean, kudos to you and Dan for getting your Santana shares when you did. But for this week, I would expect that, you know, Bender and Santana will be probably high double digits, if not maybe low triple digits in some leagues, just the way the leagues are run, I think.
That makes a lot of sense. And I want to ask you, Dan, can you help me with the little problem I have overspending on closers and OCs in 12-teamers when I already have a bunch? So I'm in a situation where in main events, I wasn't going to pay market price or what I assumed was market price for Luke Jackson. And even in spots where I could or maybe needed a real, you know, second or third guy, I wasn't going to spend $300, and I don't recall exactly what his AW or average winning bid was, but it was pretty high 200s or something. But in OCs, I have like combos of like Devin Williams with Iglesias. I have AJ Puck is pretty much my third, and I still bid like 120 to 150 on Luke Jackson. I just couldn't help myself, and I don't even love him. But I ended up overbidding him winning. The runner-up bids were for the most part like, I don't know, 50, 70. So I felt a little dumb about it. And especially when I went to go set my lineups, and obviously not trying to make excuses for myself, but if didn't have all the content to do, Sunday updates, setting lineups, for the player, for our playing time projections. I feel like I probably would have been more careful with it, but there I am. I'm like, oh, wait, am I starting Luke Jackson or AJ Puck this week? Right. And so then I'm putting myself in a pickle where I'm have an overabundance of closers and I can mistime them, right? Like I sit the wrong guy, then the other guy gets a bunch of saves. Thankfully, Puck and Jackson both have been getting saves. I think I have them split on teams, but should I just not be spending in the hundreds for guys if I have closers? Maybe rhetorical there.
If you've got two top tier closers and a third guy that will pick up the occasional save, like a Puck, you don't need to spend over 100 on a fourth guy. That's just, I don't want to criticize Breach. You. You're the no, fat whisperer me. Here. A guy like Luke Jackson, I don't think he's that dissimilar to the Dennis Santana situation, the Anthony Bender situation. He's a little more clear right now because Bruce Bochy clearly wants Jackson to be the closer. They don't seem to want Chris Martin at 38 years old to be in that role only. Robert Garcia is young. He's left-handed. Seems like they want to use him in the late innings, but maybe a little more situationally. I think he'll factor in, Garcia will, probably more than Chris Martin, as long as Luke Jackson is pitching well enough to keep that job. It's probably Jackson, situational saves go to Garcia. Martin is kind of the versatile guy. So Jackson, he's one of those guys, he's had some good seasons at the major league level, but he's not been consistent. He was not good last year at all. I mean, could he throw up a 2.5 ERA, with a one whip and save 30 games? Yeah, anyone can do it. Relievers have these just out of nowhere seasons pretty frequently. It happens. So you could hit gold, definitely, but not likely. So spending 100 on that type of pitcher, it's probably not going to work out as often as we want it to.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. You know what it also is? It's the feel of, I just want to be set. I don't want to, and that's not always the best way to look at it, because a guy like Luke Jackson could be very, like you said, very unsettling. And in 2 weeks, it's a whole different story, but I don't want to like spend money during the year on closers. I just kind of want to not think about it. I want to work on, optimizing streaming best offenses, picking up the best starters. And there's something about the way I build where I just want to just have that, that sort of, confidence with my relievers. Speaking of confidence, or maybe lack of, AJ Puck. So we had a subscriber was asking me if I would drop AJ Puck or trade him for Justin Martinez. And I mean, obviously I've been the high guy on AJ Puck, and we've seen him come out the last couple of days, get the saves, albeit given a bomb, so like DeVolpe and someone else. But then he was like, I don't know if he was like asking me and then you, but he's like, oh, but Dan said that, he likes Justin Martinez more over the course of the year. So I want to hear it. Let's, I trust you more than me on relievers now. So what is it about? Is it about Puck or is it about Martinez that you see Martinez kind of standing out this year?
I think that will probably end up as one of those 60-40 kind of situations. I wrote, I can't remember if it was a direct message or not, but I wrote, I could see at the end of the year with Martinez having 21 saves and Puck with 14, something like that. With Justin Martinez, that first Diamondbacks save went to Puck in the ninth. He gave up the home run, I think it was to Ben Rice. But if you look at the eighth inning when Martinez came in, he faced Judge, I can't remember exactly who it was, but it was the middle of the Yankees order. It was the right-handed batters, and he mowed them down, three strikeouts. Then Puck came in for that latter half of the Yankees lineup where it was three lefties in a row. To me, it was pretty clear. It was situational. This is not AJ Puck's the guy and Martinez is the setup man. This is Martinez is throwing 100 miles an hour to the right-handers. Puck is coming in against the lefties. Most of the time, it will be the opposite. Martinez will be the one in the ninth inning because Puck comes in the eighth to face a tough lefty that's coming up. So I think more often than not, Martinez will be the guy getting the ninth inning, just because that's the way the matchups more frequently work, right-handed, left-handed. But then at a higher organizational level, Martinez has that five-year extension. There's cost certainty now with his contract. The Diamondbacks, they don't care if he saves 30 games. His salary is not going up in arbitration because he's now a closer. So they're free to use him as much in the ninth and give him as many saves as they want. It's not going to cost them anymore.
Yeah, I agree. I also don't like the other two lefties in the pen, Mantiply and Beeks. And so I would think the Diamondbacks are best suited using Puck to face the toughest lefties, whether it's the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning. And I think that's the way it's shaping up. And I think the manager said something in the beginning, like right around the end of spring training, saying, you know, that he was open to having a single closer, but he wasn't ready to make that call. I think both Puck and Martinez both had very strong spring trainings. And so I think he said something like he was going to let it play out. And I think we're seeing that now.
I may be imagining it, but I feel like there was a good 1 year that Jalen Beeks had a good season. I don't know what it is, but I've seen him the last few years and he's just been atrocious. Poor guy had to pitch in Coors, of course. But it's, hasn't been good. I think even got cut by the Astros right before the season started or something. But anyways, that's a topic for another time. We got only a little bit of time left here, but we wanted to just really quickly just dive into the weekend schedules, just kind of give it an overview, see if there are any starts versus sits that the guys here might help you out with. Again, I'm here with Mike Mager at Brox Yankees 23, and of course Dan Thompson, Red Fox Roto, both colleagues here at FTN Fantasy. The weekend schedule. So first of all, for those that are in the Discord and here at FTN, you might know that we are working on some upgrades with the projections. The in-season custom rankings and projections tools. There are some things that you will see over the course of the next week or two, like the dollar values on the players. It's going to be similar to our standard deviation from last year. So you'll have like a number value based on whatever your league settings that you set the custom scoring for. And then same thing, if you go to if you have like ESPN or Yahoo Points League, those projections will be set there. But we're also going to have custom date sets. So, for example, you want to just see Monday, your league plays Monday through Friday or something like that. You can just set the scoring period for those days and get projections for those 5 days. The one thing to know, by the time you listen to this, likely, hopefully sometime on Friday, maybe you're listening to it later, but on Friday morning, our weekly projections, they switch over to just the weekend. So if you go on Friday morning to the FTN Custom Rankings and Projections tool, you will see just 3 games on there for most teams, probably except for Houston, Minnesota, because they play 2 games on the weekend. So you'll have just the weekend projections. We'll add that custom date functionality later. But just looking over some of these games, let me know what stands out here. The A's are heading out to Coors Field. You got a pitching duel times 3 with the Dodgers and the Phillies. Yamamoto against Lizardo. Roki Sasaki against Aaron Nola. And then Tyler Glasnow against our boy Christopher Sanchez. You got the Braves still not winning games. They're going to face the Marlins for 3 games at home. The Reds are in Milwaukee, mostly these like weird bullpen guys because all their guys are on IL, it seems. The Cardinals go to Fenway Park for 3 games there. I believe it's like Fetty, Palante, and Mikolas pitching. And then, let's start with that. Let me know, anyone stands out as far as who you might recommend starting, sitting, things like that.
Well, these are the first Coors Field games, I believe, right? So I know I ended up with a lot of Ryan McMahon late. I took a shot on a power breakout from Michael Tolia in a lot of places. So these are the games you drafted those guys for, the Coors Field games. So, definitely try and take advantage of any time any team is in Coors Field. I mean, that's an obvious one. There's not much insight there.
I was going to say, by the way, Mickey Moniak, he started the last couple games now. I mean, he's just batting, eighth or ninth, whatever. But he kind of looks like a starter now. You know what's weird? Tyler Freeman who everybody had drafted early. As soon as he was traded over there, it's like, oh, Tyler Freeman season, you know, 15-15 incoming. And I think he was like hurt or something in the beginning of the year, but like he has hardly played. Kyle Farmer's been playing a lot because Thairo Estrada's been on the IL. And then Jordan Beck, he had started against the lefties for the first three games, or I'm sorry, against the righties. And he sat for Moniak the last couple of games. But I don't know. We're really diving in too deep here. You got to be in like 20 team leagues to be starting Moniak.
A couple of things that stand out to me. One is, I think you mentioned it, but the Twins and Astros only have two games this weekend. And that's something fantasy managers should be cognizant of because it's very unusual. Usually you can set your Friday to Sunday lineups knowing that all teams are playing all three games. So that's one thing. You mentioned the Braves. I think this is a big series for Atlanta. I mean, they've gone winless. The bats have been very quiet, and they get to come home against Miami, Meyer, Quantrill, and Alcantara. I am looking for the Braves bats to wake up this weekend, and if they don't, that could be a bad sign. And also, the Cubs-Padres will be a fantastic series, and I just note that the Cubs have Imanaga and Boyd, two lefties, going. So, you know, it may impact how you feel about some Padres. Probably not a great weekend for, like, Jake Cronenworth, or certainly if you've been streaming Gavin Sheets, this might not be a great weekend for a player like that.
When I saw the Houston-Minnesota two-game series, because I had missed this in past years, my first thought is, wait, is this a series happening in Mexico or Puerto Rico that I didn't catch on? But that's not the case. In fact, I learned right before the pod that they actually canceled those series, like they had last year in Mexico. And apparently for economic reasons, not finding promoters. But anyways, it did not work out. No Mexico series this year. I wanted to mention also the Yankees. They're going to get the two of the Pirates lefties, though not necessarily all that amazing guys, but these games are in Pittsburgh. Obviously, streaming hitters in Yankee Stadium much better. But a guy like Ben Rice, who's been really hot, it does still seem to me like he's Mike, you're the resident Yankees guy. He's pretty much a platoon bat, right? He's probably going to sit twice against the lefties.
Yeah, I think he's still being used as a platoon. So I would not expect – I'd expect him to just get one game.
Anything else that stands out here for the weekend series or anyone else we might recommend to sit in NFBC? If we don't have anyone, we got a little bit of fab to talk about here. Mike, I want to start with you here with you're probably going to be preparing the tables for the disaster starting pitchers and the drops. We talked about David Bednar, but anyone else who you might be featuring in your article this weekend?
Yeah, there's a few I'm going to look to cover. At this point in the year, what I've been advising readers in the article is not to overreact to a week of poor performance. And so if you drafted a hitter, to drop them now on 30 plate appearances, or even a starter on one or two bad starts, I think it's probably overreaction unless the player is marginal to begin with and there's a kind of a more attractive option available. But for any of your core players, I'm not recommending drops based really on performance. I'm trying to limit and highlight potential drops based on injuries or real changes in circumstances. And on the injury front, there's still quite a few. In addition to Bednar, I think Colton Cowser is going to be a decision fantasy managers are going to have to make. He's looking at probably an 8-week or 2-month absence with a fractured thumb. Jerickson Profar, not an injury, but a PED suspension, 3 months. I think that's an easy drop, but I know some people are going to have difficulties dropping someone who is a relatively high pick on the Braves. Sean Manaea is a it's going to be an interesting decision. He suffered a setback. They're going to shut him down for a couple of weeks and then look to build him back up. So, you know, sometimes stashes are very attractive, but they're not risk-free. And it sounds like people expecting or hoping to see Manaea in mid to late April are going to have to wait a number of weeks past that. And so they're going to have to kind of make a decision on him. Maybe a more marginal pitcher now, which sounds funny because he's a future Hall of Famer, but you know, Max Scherzer was a late round pick this year. He's still having issues with his thumb. He went on the IL. You know, is he worth, you know, is he going to be back in a couple of weeks? Maybe. Is the thumb issue going to go away? Maybe not. So I think there's going to be some interesting players to dive into this weekend. Of course, that's before we even get into this weekend. And who knows, you know, how many players are going to pull an oblique running from home plate to first.
The Colton Cowser is brutal, especially, I mean, he was a big target, I think, for a lot of sharp folks. And started seeing him going in the ninth rounds in some of the main events, even higher than that. And, you know, he was starting off the season leading off with Gunnar Henderson sideline. I believe Gunnar Henderson should be back on Friday, they say. He's been hitting bombs in the minors. But yeah, so that's brutal. I have him in a main, and yeah, I might, I mean, looks like I might have to drop him. Looks like he's going to end up on someone else's team. I do think Jurickson Profar is an easy one. 80 games, you know, 3 months of the season. I think he's just a cut at this point in all formats. But anyone for you, Dan, that stands out either from a drops perspective or somebody people might be looking at in a big fab target this weekend?
Well, I'm so focused on relievers in this early part of the season that most of the guys I would name would be the relief pitchers, because this is typically the time of year where you see the most overreaction, not just by fantasy players, but by MLB managers. One blown save is really magnified when it's your only blown save, you know, not where a guy has 10 saves and he blows one. Okay, no big deal. You know, he'll go out for the next one. But some of these marginal closer types going out, and I mean, we saw in Cincinnati on the very first day, Terry Francona said very honestly, I don't know who my closer is going to be. Now Alexis Diaz is on the IL and he's going to start, you know, away from the team. Emilio Pagan, Taylor Rogers, Tony Santillan, Scott Barlow. He had experience there. He had intriguing, you know, young arm there. And the first guy to get the save opportunity was Ian Gibeau.
Yeah.
I mean, it surprised everybody, but maybe Francona really was telling the truth. He didn't know what he wanted to do, and that's just how the first one played out. Four earned runs later, okay, it's not Ian Gibeau anymore. Emilio Pagan got the next one. But what if Pagan gives up a couple homers and three runs in his next opportunity? So this is a chance where you can go for some of those lesser relievers who could ascend into the role if the guy ahead of them, who's a little shaky, has some shaky outings. But then also guys like Bednar, Alexis Diaz, maybe Jason Foley. If you can spare the roster spot for a week or two, if you don't have injuries hitting your team yet, those are guys you can pick up for maybe a dollar or two and just hold on your bench for a little bit of time. Alexis Diaz probably will get a chance in the ninth inning when he comes back. Bednar might not be down very long. Now, he'll be dropped this week and available the following week, but that's the kind of situations we want to try and capitalize on cheaply in Fab, you know, as opposed to going for the big dollar targets. But for starting pitchers, this might be the week to add Zebby Matthews cheaply. He was drafted on a lot of teams, so he should be available in Fab. And you maybe pick him up for a dollar or two. If Chris Paddock's next start, maybe not nine earned runs again, but if he gives up five, six runs, it just doesn't look right. Maybe Matthews is the guy that gets the call up and gets the chance. You'd rather get him for a couple bucks before he's called up than have to spend, you know, 40, 50 after he's called up. And so it's just kind of looking ahead at some of the players who have struggled a bit and who were maybe on shaky ground in their role to begin with and who could lose that job. Who might replace them? So Zebby Matthews may be a guy like that. Alexis Diaz could be a stash. Someone like Yennier Cano on Baltimore, it looks like he's earned his way back to that, you know, seventh, eighth inning type role rather than earlier. And we know that Felix Bautista is not available for back-to-backs. He's not available to throw a lot of pitches in a short period of time. Someone in Baltimore will be picking up an odd save now and then when Bautista's not available. And right now, Cano might be that guy. I'll throw him in some stream or some pews, you know, some pews for a dollar or two at the end. And if I add him, yeah, you know, maybe you can throw him in there if you don't have six or seven starters whose matchups that you like, you know, and he can earn a save.
So I was just going to say real quick on Zebby Matthews. So, man, main event manager is just way too sharp, man. So I was looking at it because I'm already starting to fill out the data table over there for the FAP preview. And Zebby Matthews is only available in 14% of main events, which is crazy. So, like, you know, he's like kind of the perfect target. And especially after that Chris Paddock shaky outing, I did go to check in on because based on what you just said, even though Zebby Matthews looked much better than David Festa in the preseason, I figured based on early season results in the actual AAA season might dictate who comes up next, because I do think they're sort of neck and neck. I thought I was seeing a typo because David Festa and Zebby Matthews both had almost the exact same start for their first start in the minors. They each pitched five innings in their starts. They each got four strikeouts, no walks. And it was just like, you know, a one hitter for Zebby versus a four hitter for, or three hitter for Festa. So anyways, you can't have better sort of next men up in the pen. And it's, I mean, in that rotation, and it's only a matter of time, really is, before Chris Paddock is out of there, before Simeon Woods Richardson is out of there. I mean, dude, you had a gimme against the White Sox and you got. So, you know, matter of time.
Yeah, I can't imagine he's going to last too much longer, either due to performance or health reasons.
What about Jake Mangum? If he continues, like say he gets a couple more stolen bases this weekend, or he hits a home run, or he keeps getting hit fourth. I mean, he's kind of been like, so I don't know. I had Cameron Meisner over him, and then just literally within a day, Mangum steals three bases. Then he's hitting, you know, third or fourth in the lineup, or fourth or fifth in the lineup every day. Now he's kind of the new it guy. Is he another guy that might go for triple digit? I mean, it doesn't feel like it's worth it, right? But you never know in these situations. He can end up being one of those guys. But a 29-year-old rookie, I'm trying to even figure out why it took him so long to get to the majors.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like he should be going that high, but if he continues to run and hit over 500, you can expect some pretty big bids. But then the next question is, will they be profitable or not? And I'm trying to pull the name out of the hat. The red shortstop last year.
David Hamilton?
No, on the Reds, who had like one amazing week, was super big in free agency, and then like you never heard from him again. And he was
Rhys Hines.
Yes, that's him. I just wonder. I'm not saying Mangum's going to have the same fate, but you know, people should not overreact to a one or two hot weeks. I mean, I think he's certainly a worthwhile target. I know he's going to be in some of my fab strings. And I also know, you know, the days of getting him for single digits are long past, but I'm not sure he belongs in triple digit territory. And if people are going to bid that in my leagues, they can have him.
Yeah. Mangum is 11% owned in main events, even less so in the OC. So I think those that were prioritizing a Tampa guy went for Misner, and even he wasn't all that hot. I mean, these are both guys that went for about an average of $15 last week. So yeah, I mean, I think more interesting guys in 15 teamers, Heston Kjerstad, if we think he continues to get the playing time with Colton Cowser out, this new, I mean, listen, anyone that, any of us that were snagging Wilmer Flores shares in the 40th rounds are stoked. I don't know if many of them are us are playing him, right? Unless you already have a bunch of injuries to corner infield, but he's been red hot. And then just on the 12 team point, I wanted to ask you guys, what do you do about like specific, like situational categorical plays? Like are these guys worth it in 12 teamers? Like a Jacob Wilson, who obviously seems like a riser. He is a very good real life player and he is a rookie and all, but you know, the high batting average, at what point are you starting to look at things like that? Or are you just playing it to schedule? Or like a Michael Massey, who would hit cleanup for the most part when the Royals are facing a bunch of righties, and this is behind three really, you know, great hitters. And then maybe even somebody like a Ryan Bliss, who is going to be running a lot, stealing a lot of bases. But I know, Dan, you're a little bit more of a 12 team player than Mike loves to stick with the 15s. But like, what do you think about guys like that?
Well, yeah, in a 12 team league, I mean, those aren't guys you're adding that you want to have in your lineup full time. A player like Jacob Wilson, though, they're going to Coors Field. You put a high contact, high average hitter, a series in Coors Field, that's a perfect streaming situation. So I think for any manager that has like their utility spot just open and they were just planning to kind of stream and cycle through it, yeah, those are the kind of matchups you want to take advantage of. Someone like Ryan Bliss, if you're tracking week to week, kind of where you stand against, you know, your season long targets, and you know you've come up short on stolen bases, and you just want to get a steals guy in there for a week and see if you can, you know, get two or three out of them and catch up. Yeah, perfect opportunity to put Bliss in there. He's getting the almost every day playing time. Dylan Moore is still going to get starts at second, so Bliss won't play every day. But Bliss is a great speed option for a week. But he's not a guy you want to have to leave in your lineup. So for 12 teamers, they're more streaming plays than someone you want to bid a lot on because you have to have them on your team for the rest of the year. You think they can make a huge impact for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think also players like Bliss, I try not to roster unless there's a big stolen base need, which I wouldn't be even identifying at this point of the season. I mean, just players like that are going to hurt you in average, home runs, and ribbies. And honestly, on Seattle, hitting low in the lineup is probably going to hurt you in runs too. And so it's easy to focus on what they do. But and even if he runs a decent amount, he's probably going to hurt you in four categories or at least three. So I'd stay away there. Jacob Wilson, I think is can be relevant a little more. Certainly, I agree with Dan that it's a good streaming opportunity going to Coors. I wonder though if his home stadium is almost like a Coors Light, and so his home park might be very beneficial too. So he could be in a good hitting situation for much of the season. And I think batting average is probably one of the toughest or most scarce categories in Roto. And so I see a bigger use for him. And Massey, I think is a really interesting player. I was just trying to count. I think I have either 10 or 11 shares of him. He was someone I like to pop in the early reserve rounds. I just think there's more power there, opportunity. I think he can develop into something more than a streaming option, although certainly in a 12 teamer, he's no more than that at this point in time.
That's good. That's good stuff there, guys. I appreciate it. And Yeah, I think to me stands out Jacob Wilson. I think he's the real deal. I think he's a player. I think he's somebody we should be looking at in all formats. I didn't want to mention this one thing, and this is maybe a little bit more helpful for DFS players, but it's really hard to find like stolen bases against data. And even, I mean, I think even on FanGraphs can't really find it. MLB, like, you know, catchers giving up stolen, or if there is, I haven't been able to find it. There's a site called teamrankings.com, and I just like kind of Google this, but I've looked at it for DFS. Sometimes I look at it for streaming, but I was just curious as you guys were talking, I wanted to see what teams are giving up a whole bunch of stolen bases so far. And so at the bottom of the pack, and this is just like stolen bases per game allowed, it's the teams giving up the fewest are the Giants, Padres, Mets, and White Sox. And they're giving up maybe 1/5 of a stolen base per game. So obviously they've only given up whatever that is, 5 total. Meanwhile, the worst are the Marlins. The Miami Marlins are giving up 2.3 stolen bases per game. Cue up the Augustin Ramirez bids here eventually. I don't even know if he's that great defensively, but that's got to be better than Fortes and Liam Hicks. And then after that, it's Texas and Atlanta and Cleveland and Sacramento. Those are the other teams giving up like 1.5 or more stolen bases a game. So take from that what you will.
Yeah, I think part of it is you have to look at who their opponents were. Like, I know the Marlins had a very successful, 4-game series against the running Pirates. So their numbers are going to kind of look a little exaggerated, perhaps.
This has been great, guys. I mean, this is like, I feel, I got both. First of all, I got the Dan Thompson debut, which is great. We did a stream together, like a live stream. I'm like, man, I know we hired a good one. You've been a longtime FTN subscriber before this and everything. I'm like, man, we just really have a really smart team. I feel like I'm always learning more and getting smarter every time we have this. So this has been a great trio here. But before we head out, is there any other advice or anything you guys want to mention or anything before we call it a night?
Don't overreact to 1 week. I mean, some of the things we've seen so far will be a sign that a guy is having a breakout season, but we just don't know yet. So don't overreact to 1 week, especially with drops. Or don't rage drop somebody you drafted in the first 5 rounds because they went 0-15 in their first 3 games. Just let things play out a little bit. Keep your fab bids reasonable. You know, don't blow your budget on low probability outcomes, and you know, just see where you stand in a couple weeks, but just don't overreact. It's too early.
I'm going to second that. And one of the players I put into my drops column this past week was Nestor Cortes. And I did it as an excuse to tell people not to engage in anger drops because, God, if there was ever someone I wanted to anger drop last week, it was Cortes. 3 pitches, 3 home runs allowed, just got obliterated in Yankee Stadium. Velo was down. And I can just report right now that he just got a win tonight against the Reds. 6 innings, 1 hit allowed, 0 yep. runs. So yeah, there's an example of the potential risk of anger dropping a player, and at this point, watch your teams, manage your teams, but don't obsess over standings in early April, and don't overreact to them.
Yeah, nailed it. That's a perfect example. We also kind of knew what was going to happen with Nestor, unfortunately, with the scars left from last year and all, but you kind of had a feeling something like that might happen. So not a surprise that he came in there and dominated the Reds today. And don't drop Michael Toglia either. It's happening. It's coming. Like Dan and Mike said, it's a long season, and we will be fine. Just got to stick with it. So, guys, thank you so much for coming on. You guys will be on the show throughout the course of the season. So great to have you. For Dan Thompson, for Mike Mager, and of course for Jason Anthony, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll talk to you next week.